Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an appraisal of last night's raucous Republican presidential debate in South Carolina ahead of next Saturday's primary, and speak with Andy Brack, a veteran political analyst of South Carolina's politics, who is founder and editor of Statehouse Report. He joins us to assess the likely winners and losers in this key primary state that could propel Donald Trump towards the nomination or slow down his momentum as the other contenders fight for second place. Then, with the death of the leading conservative on the Supreme Court, Justice Antonin Scalia, we'll explore what options and strategies the White House and the Senate Democratic minority might employ in the next 11 months to get a replacement for Justice Scalia, nominated then confirmed on the court in this increasingly contentious election year. Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate who served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us to discuss how the Democrats can get around a determined Republican majority in the Senate who have vowed to block any nominee, even a nominee who has been unanimously approved by them, to a lower court. Then we look into the life and legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia with a former law clerk for Scalia's close friend on the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, joins us to discuss how this leading conservative voice on the court changed the way arguments are presented and argued before the court, as well as Scalia's impact on the political, economic, and social life of the country that has moved in a conservative direction since Antonin Scalia was appointed by Ronald Reagan. Then finally, we examine the issue that has become the main policy argument between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in their campaigns for the Democratic presidential nomination, health care, and whether to improve the Affordable Care Act or go to a single-payer system that most of the other advanced economies have. Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive whose latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It, joins us to discuss what is driving the rising costs of health care that have not been curbed by the Affordable Care Act. And joining us now is Andy Brack, a veteran political analyst of South Carolina's politics and the founder and editor of Statehouse Report, where he provides weekly commentary. A former U.S. Senate press secretary and reporter, he also serves as president and chairman of the Center for a Better South. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Brack.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Andy. And obviously the incredibly raucous debate that took place last night in South Carolina. You're in Charleston. I take it was nearby. But let me just read a tweet from Frank Luntz, the Republican campaign guru. Seriously, this is insane. The GOP is destroying itself tonight, and they have no one to blame but themselves. So yep. What was your impression?
You know, the headlines down here, I think, correctly captured it. It was a brawl. It was as if there were no adults in the room, except maybe John Kasich. I mean, it was just a mess. It certainly did not bode well for the way that politics should be. South Carolina is a place where things do get messy. We've got a long history of things getting messy down here, and a lot of folks kind of figure out to see if you can take a punch down here, and if you can, then that might change their minds.
Well, I understand that 65% of the Republican voters are Christian coalition members or religious right or whatever you want to describe them as. There's also a big military contingent on the Republican right. side. I was struck by Donald Trump's, and frankly, he's the only person almost in the entire American political landscape that's ever held the Bush-Cheney administration to task for their disastrous foreign policy in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, it's so unusual to hear a Republican telling the truth about what a disaster the Iraq war was, which should be evident to everybody. But in terms of the military people that you know down in South Carolina, do you think they'd be were swayed? Because there were a lot of boos in support of Jeb Bush, who came to the defense of his family and its name and reputation.
You know, down here, I think a lot of people would have sided with the Bushes on that thing. There were a lot of boos. I have breakfast every Saturday morning with a bunch of country club Republicans, and they're not very impressed by Donald Trump. They don't understand what his appeal is. I think that you're going to see him go down a little bit. Right now in the polls, he's up 20%, 20 points. He's got about a third of the vote, and he's 20 points ahead of anybody else, according to the latest stuff that I've seen. But I think with the performance last night and the bullying and the mocking and all this, that, and the other, that South Carolina conservatives are going to be taking a look at Jeb Bush a little harder and taking a look more at John Kasich.
So is that to say that there's that sort of Southern gentility was offended? I mean, I know I'm sort of harking back to Ashley in the classic movie, but nevertheless, is there such a thing? And if so, was Trump simply offensive?
I don't know if there's as much gentility these days as people think there is, especially in South Carolina Republican politics, given the history we've got here. But I think he was just offensive to a lot of people. I mean, that the audience was in Greenville, South Carolina, which is a kind of a buckle of the Bible Belt in South Carolina. And people here like both President Bushes, and they remember them fondly. It was a bitter pill, I think, for a lot of people to swallow, for the Bushes to be attacked.
And again, I'm speaking with Andy Brack, a veteran political analyst of South Carolina's politics and the founder and editor of State House Report, where he provides weekly commentary, a former U.S. Senate press secretary and reporter. He also serves as president and chairman of the Center for a Better South. And of course, it struck me as something of an irony, Andy, that the center down there in Greenville, where the debate took place, was called the Peace Center. There was nothing but war on that stage.
That's exactly right.
So in terms of, though, the Republicans, you say country club Republicans that you have breakfast with, some of them, you told me earlier, were generals and right. colonels in the military. What's their sense? What do you think the military vote? Who's going to get the military vote? None of those people on the stage is a veteran.
Yeah, I think that they're going to kind of default back to more to Jeb Bush. I mean, he's still not very high up in the polls. The guys that I have breakfast with are establishment Republicans. And, you know, this election, what we're seeing is if you combine Cruz and Trump, that's about half the electorate in most polls. And they're people that are just angry at the establishment. I don't know. I hope that South Carolina will clarify that some, and maybe the establishment candidates will do a little bit better. But right now, it's just a mess down here, and it's one of the things that I wrote. We have a weekly thumbs up, thumbs down in politics, and I gave a in the middle to presidential politics. I said, thank you very much for coming to South Carolina. We're really ready for you to leave about now. It's going to be interesting to see what happens here. One of the things that I think that you've also got to keep in mind is that there is a long history of evangelical votes here, but it's different from Iowa, where I understand people kind of coalesce around one candidate. That's not as big of a thing here. People make up their own minds. They don't like being told what to do. But Ted Cruz has about 10,000 workers, according to some reports, who are trying to rope Christian evangelicals into the Cruz camp. I don't know how successful that's going to be. I didn't see a stellar debate performance last night. And like I said, I don't know if the debate last night clarified anything. We are anticipating a week full of campaign stops and headlines all week of candidates going back and forth across the state.
Well, there seems to be a mathematical problem, though, that the second-tier candidates have with Trump, because they're all sort of canceling themselves out. And that probably will continue. Rubio seemed to have redeemed himself a little bit, but I understand you mentioned earlier, the sort of nasty contact sport, mudslinging nature of South Carolina Republican politics. I understand there's a prominent blogger down there that's going to release what he calls a mistress bomb, which is supposedly aimed at Marco Rubio, alleging that he has a mistress who bought a house for down in Florida.
If it's the same fellow that I think that you're talking about, he would have been one who claimed he had an affair with our current governor. So, you know, it is interesting down here. The gloves definitely come off. I mean, it goes back to the 1950s when upstate candidates, which are in that Bible Belt, would complain about people from Charleston being bad and evil because they drank liquor. I mean, it's matured into that, into religion politics back in the late 70s when Lee Atwater, who you know has been kind of, he had called himself the bad boy of politics years ago, but he helped orchestrate a push-poll campaign for a Republican candidate who later became governor, and the push-poll basically said, would you vote for a candidate who did not accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? And interestingly, the Democratic candidate running was Jewish, so of course he did not accept Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior, but it led people to believe that there was something wrong with him. And then, you know, it's gone to, in 2000, there was a push poll done about John McCain suggesting that he illegally fathered a black child. And I mean, the negativity and the roughness of the sport are definitely down here. The one thing that seems to be more interesting in this election is that people are watching for it, because thanks to social media, thanks to Twitter and to Facebook and to all these other things, anything really negative gets reported really quickly, and the newspapers are looking for it. The Post and Courier here in Charleston, which won the Pulitzer Prize last year, has a continuing outcry and outreach to people that says, if you hear of something nasty, let us know. They're kind of just having a nasty watch. So as far as I know, nothing really bad has been reported on that, but we are in this last week before the GOP primary next week, and you know, everybody's kind of gripping the sides of their chair like if you're on a roller coaster, you know, waiting to go down the big hill.
And, of course, just in closing, Andy Brack, the death of Justice Scalia does change the political landscape in this election year. It's obvious that the fight over getting somebody to replace him will be front and center, and it'll probably actually give the Democrats some ammunition. You know, they usually argue at the end of the day, well, we may not have the best candidate, but you better vote for us, otherwise we're going to have more conservatives on the Supreme Court. Well, yeah. this year that argument's really going to work.
Well, and the thing that's really disingenuous about the Republican calls for delay is that, what do you think would happen if the foot were on the other foot, you know, or the shoe were on the other foot? What would happen if there were a Republican president and a member of the Supreme Court died? You think that the Republican Party would say, oh, no, we have to wait till the next president? I don't think that would happen. I think this is completely a disingenuous political move. And, in fact, it's kind of offensive that Justice Scalia's long service on the Supreme Court has been besmirched in this way. I mean, the guy's not even in the grave yet, and there's being politics thrown around that's just nasty. I mean, he while some people may not have agreed with him and his constitutional stances, he certainly did a service for the country since 1985, and we should remember that and instead of getting down into the gutter.
Well, Andy Brack, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, Ian, thank you very much, and please give my best to Jim Manley, who served as a press secretary when I was up in Washington as a press secretary.
Thank you for joining us, Andy Brack.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thank
Ian.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Andy Brack, who is a veteran political analyst of South Carolina's politics and the founder and editor of State House Report, where he provides weekly commentary. A former U.S. Senate press secretary and reporter, he also serves as president and chairman of the Center for a Better South. We're going to take a brief station break and be back exploring what options and strategies the White House and the Senate Democratic minority have in getting a replacement for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He serves as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to talk to you again.
And
good to hear Andy's voice again. He was a good man.
Yes, well, he wanted to give you a shout out, so I'll pass that on. So, so this obviously, and the point that I think Andy made is well taken, that Antonin Scalia is not even in the ground yet, and there's all this political fighting going on. Of course, it's worth noting that it was started by Mitch McConnell and Mike Lee, who came immediately out of the gate and said there's no way the Senate, this Republican Senate, is going to approve any nominee from President Obama. So so what are their strategies and options that the White House and the Senate Democrats have?
Oh, I don't know how many options the administration has except for what the president, in fact, intends to do, select the best qualified nominee, send it up to the Senate, and hope and expect that the Judiciary Committee does what it's supposed to do and has a up or down vote on the nominee. Whether that, in fact, happens or not remains to be seen. The administration doesn't have many other options besides that. They can't try a recess appointment. Let me get that out of the way first of all. McConnell can simply get around that or block that very simply, very quickly. But again, so the question is for your listeners is, in light of the comments by Senator McConnell, that does the administration send up a moderate nominee in the hope that Senator McConnell will back down for whatever reason, allow a vote, or does the president realize or recognize, in light of Senator McConnell's comments, that the only thing he has to do here is fight and send up a very liberal and or progressive nominee and let the chips fall where they may? I, having said that, I'm in the second camp. I find Senator McConnell's comments appalling, goes against the very core of what the Senate stands for, and so the administration should take him up on his challenge and send up a highly qualified liberal nominee and let the chips fall where they may.
Well, there's already some talk that President Obama may nominate Srinivasan, who is an Indian American, recently nominated and voted unanimously 97-0 by this Republican majority Senate to the court below the Supreme Court.
Yep.
So how would that? I mean, is there any way you can shame them by pointing out, well, this is a guy that you just approved a couple of years ago? So how come things?
They would argue. Yeah, they would argue that, well, this is a different ball game. This is for Supreme Court, et cetera. But you raise a interesting point. Can they be shamed? I'm not so sure they can be shamed, but millions of Americans, including those in states represented by what's left of moderate Republicans who are up for re-election this year, can suggest to their senators that they demand to be enfranchised by having the Senate vote on a Supreme Court nominee. Whether that's going to be enough to move them off the dime remains to be seen. As we speak, conservative Republicans are working in overdrive to try and get these Republicans up for re-election next year to voice support for McConnell's Just Say No strategy. So we'll have to wait and see what comes out of that. I've seen speculation about this particular gentleman. I remember it took him a while to be confirmed. What the administration is going to do, I don't know. But again, I'll tell you another thing. Another strategy being discussed is, why don't they nominate a current senator and or someone who's already been closely vetted? And if you believe that, you know, I got a bridge to sell you. The Republicans aren't going to go for it. They can't be shamed, and so you need to nominate someone with the intellectual firepower power to put these guys in a corner.
So when the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Grassley, says that we can't possibly nominate somebody this year, in this election year, because of a precedent, an 80-year precedent, that doesn't sound accurate, because...
Well, it's not in fact, because Justice Kennedy, of course, was done in similar circumstances years ago, something that Senator Grassley conveniently is forgetting right now. But again, sorry to interrupt, but the flip side of the coin is this president was elected twice. He has, by the millions of Americans in this great country of ours. He has 11 months to go until his term ends up. There's no reason. And furthermore, the average time it takes to confirm a nominee, a Supreme Court nominee, is a little more than 2 months. There's no reason, none whatsoever, why this president doesn't deserve to have an up or down vote on his nominee to replace Justice Scalia. By the way, Andy had a lot nicer things to say about Scalia than I ever would, but he's a better man than I.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So if this is then going to dominate the this political year, which I think it will, not perhaps dominate, but certainly be a very, very central issue, doesn't this play into the Democratic narrative that we've often heard that you have to vote for our candidate, otherwise the Supreme Court's going to be packed with even more conservatives? Now you've got a 50-50 balance, if you will,
yep.
Even though that creates its own problems in terms of you know, if you get a tie, then the decision is kicked back to the lower court.
Yep.
That's not in itself a good argument why you need that. After all, when you get these originalists, and after all, Scalia was the ultimate originalist, and you got Ted Cruz as a disciple talking about originalism, well, there was an original reason why the Founding Fathers put 9 justices on the court. So there wasn't a tie. Or the possibility of a tie. So, you know, it seems to me that Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders have a really strong argument that this is why you've got to, the Democrats have got to win back the Senate as well as the White House.
Obviously, couldn't agree with you more, but the problem I have is that it just seems to me that in years past, Republicans have spent much more time focusing on the Supreme Court than Democrats ever have, if only because, you know, Democrats intrinsically believe in the rule of law and, you know, that we can sort things out. They haven't spent as much time as Republicans focusing on the Supreme Court and the impact that the Supreme Court has on their lives. So, but I think in the end, anyways, that's what I think has been in the past. I think that's going to change this time. Everyone understands, you know, that this is for all the marbles and you have to elect a Democrat for all the reasons you just articulated. Now, the question, of course, is who's going to benefit from that? Is it going to be Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders? And, you know, I think that still remains to be seen. But, yes, it really does highlight the stakes. And it there's nothing that quite clarifies the political process than a hot-button Supreme Court nominee where, you know, the issues, you know, the weighty issues are debated along with, you know, plenty of 30-second attack ads as well.
But do you think in the course of this year, if the Republican Senate does what Donald Trump suggested they do last night's debate, delay, 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 that there will be evidence of how the Supreme Court's not working because of the tie situation?
And thus getting Democrats to vote in record numbers. I sure hope and expect that's in fact the case. Well, I'll just leave it at that. I hope and expect that's the case because them not to would be ridiculous.
Well, do you think, though, that there's a combination of events now that are turning things in the favor of the Democratic candidates, particularly when in the early interview with Andy Brack, I read a tweet from Frank Luntz that was pretty devastating that he put out last night about how they're going to lose the elections as a result of this circus. This is Frank Luntz from last night. It's tweeting, "Seriously, this is insane. The GOP is destroying itself tonight, and they have no one to blame but themselves."
Yeah, I mean, I watched the debate. It was nothing short of a circus. How any Republican with half a brain would vote for any of these clowns remains to be seen, but the fact of the matter is, it is what it is. So, yes, I'd like to think that last night's debate is the beginning of the end for the Republican Party, and that everyone's going to finally realize that these guys have no clothes. But, you know, Trump, for one, never ceases to amaze me. So, but, yeah, this, again, Ian, adds urgency to the debate. It shows what's exactly at stake. It's not just laughing about how pathetic Donald Trump is or how weak Marco Rubio is or how ineffective Jeb Bush is, but really clarifies, you know, the important issues we're going to have to address. So, you know, next up, like I said, the president's going to have to nominate somebody, and then we'll see what happens.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. And joining us now is Aziz Haq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is a co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haq.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it turns out, has been a lifelong friend of Antonin Scalia's. They're very close. Apparently, her late husband was a gourmet chef, and Scalia would come to dinner regularly. Apparently, Scalia liked good food, and so they've been close well before both of them were seated on the Supreme Court. So, give us a sense of that relationship since you clerked for Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg knew each other from sitting on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and have shared interests in administrative law, which is the law that concerns what federal agencies do, and constitutional law. They're also united by a love of opera, so they would attend the opera in Washington, D.C. regularly together. And their families became very close over time. So every New Year's Eve, the Scalias would come to the Ginsburg's residence. Marty Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's now husband, who has now passed, would cook a New Year's Eve repast that was supposed to be very, very good. And they would celebrate the New Year together. And I think both of them took enormous pride in the fact that they had this close friendship, notwithstanding the very, very sharp ideological fissures between them. I think they both saw it as being really important that people who have very different views about the way the world ought to be should be able to still talk to each other and celebrate what they had in common.
Well, of course, this would should be an example to the Congress, right? But it's certainly not.
I think that the things that are driving members of Congress apart are structural forces in our political system. And for all I know, there could be many members of Congress on different sides of the aisle who are close personally to one another or who like each other personally. And I suspect that those kinds of personal relationships won't make much of a difference given the forces of campaign spending, gerrymandering, and an increasingly polarized electorate that ensure that displays of bipartisanship are punished when attempted by either political party, but perhaps especially by the Republican Party.
So now that we have already this contention, where almost immediately out of the gate, minutes after the announcement was made that the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, had died down in Texas, where he was having on a hunting vacation. Automatically, almost out of the gate, you had Mitch McConnell saying, "We're not going to, absolutely not going to approve any nominee that the president puts up in this election year." Mike Lee on the Judiciary Committee also jumped out of the gate on that. Elizabeth Warren has replied, in effect, saying Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution says the President of the United States nominates justices to the Supreme Court with the advice and consent of the Senate. I can't find a clause that says except when there's a year left in the term of a Democratic president. And already Senator Grassley, the chair of the Republican Judiciary Committee, says that there's an 80-year precedent. Well, apparently that's not true. Justice Kennedy was approved during the Reagan term in an election year.
There is a precedent for the Senate resisting the nomination of a justice in an election year and trying to hold off until until a new president was in office. It was the elevation of Abe Fortas to the chair of Chief Justice to replace Chief Justice Warren in 1968. The Senate resisted that until the 68 election had played out and Nixon was in office the following year. And Nixon went on to appoint Warren Berger rather than Fortas to that position. So there is a precedent for the Senate resisting this. And look, the Constitution gives both the President and the Senate a role in appointments. It doesn't specify how those two roles ought to be carried out. It doesn't talk about time limits. Although there is a recess appointment clause that I suspect will not play a role in the current Supreme Court justice appointment process. So the way in which the President and the Senate employ their constitutionally allocated powers in the appointment process is really a function of politics. And I think that what will be determinative here is when President Obama makes a nomination, as I expect he will, my anticipation would be he will select somebody who the current Senate has already voted on and already approved in a relatively uniform fashion. The most obvious candidate here is Sri Srinivasan, who was appointed recently to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. He will try and put forward somebody who it will at a minimum be politically embarrassing for Republicans to say no to, and so I think that then what we will see is a pitched political battle over the nomination of the confirmation of an appointee that probably neither side is terrifically keen on for ideological reasons, but neither side is terrifically opposed to. And how that plays out, I think, depends upon many things that we don't know. It depends upon a lot about the particulars of how the political battle plays out. I think that the likelihood is I'm not a a close watcher of the Senate, but I think that the likelihood is that even if a Obama candidate for the Supreme Court gets out of committee, and for the reasons you said, that may be unlikely. Even if somebody gets out of committee, I think that they will not be able to get an up or down vote on the nomination. So I think that the more likely scenario is that we will see this sucking up a lot of time and political attention and resulting in nothing before there is an election. And I think if one reflects upon what benefits both sides electorally, but especially the Republican side electorally. This is something that if you pay a lot of time and attention to but get nothing done, it's really good for getting people out to the polls.
And again, I'm speaking with Aziz Harker, professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Well, Sri Srivanasayan was approved just a couple of years ago to the D.C. Circuit Court on a 97-0 vote. And during the nomination process, Senator and current Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz called Sri Srivanasayan a longtime friend, and Republican Senator Orrin Hatch called him terrific. So they may have to eat their words, but that may not be a problem for Ted Cruz. But what's the sense of how the country's going to proceed with these tie votes that could come? The reason that the Founding Fathers had nine justices on the Supreme Court was that it would make a tie impossible.
Well, if I can respectfully offer a different view on that last point, the Constitution itself does not say how many justices have to be on the Supreme Court. It refers to a Chief Justice, but doesn't say anything about numbers. And actually, it leaves the extent of the court's powers largely up to Congress. So there's nothing in the Constitution, and indeed nothing in our traditions, that says there have to be nine justices. I'm going to resist the temptation to give you the full-on history, but the...
No, you pulled me over, and I appreciate the correction. So, but let's go ahead with what's going to happen if there are these tie votes.
Well, I think that this is tremendously significant because there are going to be, and there already are, a significant number of cases that either have been argued already or that will be argued in the coming months where it was likely that the result was going to be 5-4 with Justice Scalia probably in the majority. And here I'm thinking of the immigration case, United States versus Texas. The case involving the religious liberty objection to the contraception mandate, a case that's called Zubik. It's possible that the Texas abortion case would have been 5-4, although I think that's a much closer question. But in all of these cases, the more likely configuration of votes is now going to be 4-4. And when you have a 4-4 vote, the result of that is that the court issues a single-line order saying affirmed by a equally divided court. And whatever the opinion that was reached in the Court of Appeals gets to stand. Now, this has different effects in different cases because there are different courts of appeal. So, for example, in the Texas immigration case, the Court of Appeals opinion is extremely favorable to the conservatives, right? It's the conservative side, right? It's a very, very it basically accepts the conservative critique of President Obama's DACA and DAPA. By contrast, in the religious liberty cases, there are different courts of appeals reaching different views on the same statutory issue, on the same religious liberty issue. So if the court divides evenly there, the country just remains a checkerboard of different kinds of law or different rules about religious liberty. The one exception to this is the affirmative action case, Fisher. In Fisher, Justice Kagan was already recused because she'd played a role while she was Solicitor General in that case. And so there are now seven justices voting in Fisher. So Fisher can proceed with a much smaller chance of a tie vote. But for many other of these close cases, the court is now effectively disabled from serving as an arbiter of these big national issues. And the court, particularly under the under Chief Justice Roberts. Leadership has really set itself up as the institution that decides big national questions, be it things like the you know, whether we should have Obamacare, what kind of immigration regime we should have, what kind of national regime about gay marriage we should have, right? There isn't, you know, whatever side the court takes, the court seems to be pretty united in thinking that it gets to decide stuff. And what's really interesting about what's going to happen now is that the court, for this weird institutional reason, right, the consequences of tie votes being a nullity, for this weird institutional reason, suddenly the court has its hands tied in the perhaps highest profile, most contentious set of cases. So what we will see is how the political system operates without an institution that has effectively served as an arbiter in a whole swathe of really high-profile cases over the last few years.
Well, Aziz Haque, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the main policy argument between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over their different approaches to health care.
No one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive. He's the author of Deadly Spin and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and healthinsurance.org. His new book, now available for pre-order, is Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be back.
And I wanted to talk to you about the big argument going on between the two Democratic presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, over whose health care plan works better. But let's deal with the thesis in your new book, Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Obviously, with the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who's one of the champions of the Citizens United decision, there's a possibility, of course, that with a different balance on the Supreme Court, that the decision could be overturned. The alternatives, through an attempt to get two-thirds of the states and two-thirds of the legislatures in all the states to vote on a constitutional amendment, is a pretty much a pipe dream. So that's a realistic possibility. Do you feel that there's been a tectonic change in the landscape?
I sure do. I think it's no less than tectonic. I think that, of course, should a Republican be elected our next president, the chances of a conservative to replace him are, it's a foregone conclusion. But if either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or whoever the Democrats might pick would win the general election, I think there's a very good chance that Citizens United could and would be overturned in pretty short order.
But in terms of the Republican election and who's likely to be the candidate, what would you make of a Trump presidency, given that he's a little unconventional, to say the least? And I'm not sure, the other candidates, particularly Rubio, who's completely in the pocket of Sheldon Adelson, represents all that's wrong with campaign finance in its current form. But how would you see a Trump presidency?
It's a very good question. I would think that he, among the presidential candidates on the Republican side, would be the most inclined to see the corrupting influence of Citizens United, and very possibly could pick a candidate or a nominee for the Supreme Court who would side with the Democrats on that issue. It's a good question, and Trump has had varying issues in the past, but his position on the corruption of money in politics is very interesting, and I think it's a very good possibility that maybe he would look for someone who would see the corrupting influence of Citizens United and overturn it.
Well, it would seem to me that the reason that Trump is doing well is the fact that he is not a politician. He's
right.
Anti-politician. He really made, in the debate last night in South Carolina, he made a strong case for being a non-politician and basically dismissed everybody else on the stage as being in the pockets of lobbyists. And he seems to be resonating, as is Bernie Sanders, resonating on the Democratic side throughout the electorate. That seems to be the mood. So at least you can say that's it's an encouraging and changing political landscape, isn't it?
It really is. I think that it shows that the majority of Republicans and Democrats are really fed up with the status quo, and the status quo is gridlock, and gridlock caused by big money in politics. It may be voiced differently on the two sides, but there is certainly a common understanding of the problem, and I think that's exactly what explains, at least to a large extent, the popularity of both Trump and Bernie Sanders.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who's a former health insurance executive and the author of Deadly Spin, and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and healthinsurance.org. His new book, now available for pre-order, is Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. So in your new book, of course, you give us a little bit of a history lesson, which is certainly appropriate because we are in a new gilded age. I think unquestionably the question really is whether we are still a democracy or in the process of becoming a plutocracy ruled by an oligarchy. And back in 1896, you had the McKinley campaign against a left-wing populist. He was on the religious left, if you will, William Jennings Bryan, up against the plutocrat, who outspent Bryan enormously and then won, of course, and then was shortly thereafter assassinated. And then you had the accidental candidate who they put on the ticket to balance the plutocratic nature of the McKinley campaign. They put Teddy Roosevelt on the ticket as sort of decoration, I guess. And then, of course, he ended up becoming the president and becoming the great trust buster. So, you know,
right.
I guess life is full of ironies there. But what do you see as the main comparison there between this Gilded Age and the previous one? It seems to me, since Citizens United, you don't have to have Mark Hanna's backroom bankrolling of McKinley. Now it's done through these 501c4s.
It's true. And it's even less apparent who is, in many cases, who is doing the bankrolling because of so much dark money being flooded, that's flooding the system. But you're exactly right. These new super PACs and the entities that don't really have to, you know, they're not forced to disclose who is contributing, has changed our political dynamic in a very negative way, in my view. And I think there's, again, there's that sense of something that I think the population maybe can't put its finger on, but knows that things have gotten very corrupt in just a very short period of time.
Well, it does seem that the ruling by the IRS recently, basically legitimizing Karl Rove's Crossroads 501c4, where most of his money or the money from his donors is going, so that it's hidden and unattributed. I mean, you know, you're with the Center for Public Integrity that revealed this information, Wendell Potter. What in the hell went on at the IRS? How could they have made that decision?
You know, I think the IRS was probably spooked because of previous criticism that it had for the way it had treated organizations like this. And so I think it probably was an overreaction, and it's just absurd because these organizations are certainly not as they purport to be. They're nothing more than shills or shells for propaganda. But that's what you have. You have, I think, an IRS that was just too concerned about what would happen if it didn't rule that way, how it would be condemned and possibly be subjected to scrutiny and loss of funding in this Republican Congress.
So the Republicans, of course, made such a big deal about this sort of inflated scandal at the IRS over investigating these 501c4s, where they tried to do it in an even-handed way, but the Republicans made it seem like they were going after them.
Exactly.
And so that was the tactic then, to make
exactly
a big stink,
right.
And that way you intimidate the IRS, and eventually
right.
you get your way just to sort of bully them into submission.
Exactly.
That appears to
be... that's exactly what happened. It was intimidation.
So let me ask you, though, about since you were both the head of public relations for Humana and Cigna, and have had a career in health insurance at the very highest level, the argument that's going on now between the two Democratic presidential candidates, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, seems largely to be about different approaches to health care. In fact, I think in the broader sense, Hillary Clinton has a problem because she's a status quo politician who wants to improve the system, not change it. And that is pretty clear in her health care. She's saying we can improve the Affordable Care Act, but we're not going to change it and go to single payer, which is what Bernie Sanders is offering. Not necessarily offering how it can be done, but offering it as a goal. What's your sense then of where the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, stands? Because the principal reason for it and the principal justification was that the current healthcare system is out of control, the costs are out of control, and we're spending more of our GDP, over twice of our GDP, than the rest of the advanced economies, most of whom have single payer.
Well, you know, I think that the Affordable Care Act certainly has done some good in that it has brought a lot more people into coverage. We have fewer people who are uninsured now than in many years. The problem is it's not doing nearly enough to control healthcare costs because of the way it was structured. It is as it is because of the influence of money in politics. The administration, the Obama administration, cut a deal right out of the gate with the pharmaceutical industry to make sure that the drug companies would be okay with the legislation, that their profits wouldn't be hindered. And that's essentially what happened with the insurance industry, too, even though the insurance industry has to abide by some new regulations. They, too, are making extraordinary profits. So while the Affordable Care Act has brought people into coverage, it really has not done nearly enough to control cost. We can say that, to use the wonky term, it might have helped to bend the cost curve, but it hasn't done nearly enough to address the fundamental reasons why we have the most expensive healthcare system on the planet.
But that would suggest then that Bernie Sanders is on the right track.
Yes.
And you would agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think that the Affordable Care Act was good. It was as good as we could possibly get because of money in politics. But if we were to be able to do something to address the corrosive effect of money in politics, I think we could make progress on health care as well as many other fronts where we've seen gridlock or inadequate advances to solve a problem. Whether single payer is the ultimate way of getting to a better healthcare system remains to be seen. I don't think it necessarily is the only way, but it is, in my view, would represent a system that would be much more equitable and that would have the means to control healthcare costs a lot more than the system we have now. The reality is that health insurance companies simply are not able to control healthcare costs, and that's one reason why we continue to see healthcare costs go up as much as they do.
So President Obama learned from Hillary Clinton's efforts and how the insurance companies have sabotaged her.
Right.
And so he decided to invite them into the tent and go along with them in the hope that they wouldn't sabotage the deal.
Right.
And then he got the deal, but the deal is basically their deal, and that's both Big Pharma and big insurance.
Yes.
And it doesn't address the central issue, which is why you have insurance in the first place. In other words, insurance is an unnecessary layer between the patient and the health provider.
It is.
And that's the concept that's never been properly explained, has it?
It has not. And it hasn't been because of people who work in positions like I used to have in the insurance industry. We were great propagandists, and they still have a lot of money that they spend on campaigns to influence public opinion against single-payer systems, to make people think that the Canadian system is inferior and that people wait, you know, endless months or years for needed care in Canada. We've been able to, I say we, using my old profession, to scare people into thinking that the way that, you know, the air system is, despite its flaws, far better than any other. So we have to overcome that.
Well, I hope that Bernie Sanders at least articulates that simple concept to explain why single payer has a greater logic, which is that, you basically, it's like paying protection money to the mafia, having people that don't provide you any good whatsoever, but have inserted themselves into a situation that they control and that they bleed to death.
Exactly. And as a consequence, we waste about 30% of what we spend on health care. We waste it on administrative costs as a result of our multi-payer system of private insurance companies.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's a former health insurance executive. He's the author of Deadly Spin and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and healthinsurance.org. His new book, now available for pre-order, is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.